This press briefing this afternoon will provide a summary from this morning's Scudder oration and trauma. We're very pleased to have the Scudder orator with us for 2009, Dr. A. Brent Eastman. Dr. Eastman is Vice Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Surgeons and also the Chief Medical Officer for Scripps Health in San Diego.
There's a correction on that. I'm the Vice Chair.
He's the Vice Chair of the Board of Regents. Correction. Thank you.
And I think in addition to being the Chief Medical Officer at Scripps Health, I'm the N. Paul Whittier Chair of Trauma. So I think that's important for this. I added it in this, too.
Okay. If you want to just summarize your remarks,
okay. Well, I was asked to give the Scudder Oration, which is the annual lecture on trauma, some aspect of trauma, at the American College of Surgeons Clinical Congress each year. I guess I really began by acknowledging sort of an awesome responsibility to give this lecture to a room filled with trauma surgeons who spend every day and every night doing what you're going to be talking about. And it's meant to be, I believe, a seminal lecture to inspire action and address a major problem in the care of the injured patient. So for this lecture, I chose to speak about the creation of trauma systems. And the title I gave my lecture was Wherever the Dart Lands, Towards the Ideal Trauma System. That title required some explanation in the lecture because I was on the Institute of Medicine's Future of Emergency Care in the United States a couple of years ago, and I became one of the spokespersons for that document that the IOM took out. And I was asked when we were in Washington at a meeting with congressional people, I said, well, Dr. Eastman, what is your vision for a trauma system for the entire United States? And I'd never thought about the question, but I, on my feet, said, well, envision me blindfolded, standing in front of a map of the United States, and if I were to throw a dart at that map, wherever the dart lands when we have a trauma system, a person injured at that point would be insured of expeditious transport to the appropriate level of care commensurate with their injuries. Well, that's a lot of words, but it basically means that whether it's a rural area or a city and you are injured, a trauma system has to identify that you're injured, has to communicate to the appropriate people, has to arrange to have you transported expeditiously to the level of care appropriate with your injury. And I made a big point of that in the lecture, that appropriate doesn't always mean being put in a helicopter and being flown to a level one or level two trauma center. It may be very appropriate to be treated at the local community hospital if they have the commitment, have the expertise and the resources to care for that particular injury. And if they have transfer agreements with higher levels of trauma care, level one, level two, level one being our highest level of care, level two next, then level three, level four, so that if you develop complications or whatever, you can be moved to the appropriate level of care. I made a very large point of trying to describe an inclusive trauma system as opposed to an exclusive system. An inclusive system is really meant to encompass the entire continuum of care of an injured patient and really is meant to go beyond the injury, because an inclusive system is as committed to prevention as they are to acute care and as committed to rehabilitation as to acute care. And an inclusive system means that everybody in that particular system who is committed to caring for the injured patient has to have a role. That's in contradistinction to an exclusive system where you only focus on the most critically injured, you only focus on the level one and level two trauma centers and those patients who go there. And I think that's been part of our failure in this country to engender public awareness and support for what's probably our number one public health problem in the United States, injury. One of our problems is we use the word trauma and nobody knows what the word trauma means, and it really ought to be interchangeable with injury. So that was the way I began the lecture. I did give a historical background in the lecture, which was my own life. I grew up in Wyoming, and I talked about growing up in a very small town in Wyoming where my Uncle Gilbert was the trauma system. He was the mortician. He was the county coroner. And he was the ambulance service because the hearse, his 1951 Cadillac combo hearse ambulance, was a hearse during a funeral. And if there was a trauma, they would take the casket out, change the rollers so that they could put a gurney in, hang a sign on the side that said ambulance, and stick a magnetic red light on top, and it became the ambulance. And he allowed us how patients at the scene of a car crash would be rather disconcerted when Uncle Gilbert rolled up in his hearse ambulance and they didn't know whether they were going to the mortuary or to the little 25-bed hospital. But that really set the stage to talk about my first experience with mass casualties and trauma, and that was what I chose to call the Great Train Wreck. And that was the town I grew up in Evanston, Wyoming, was on the Union Pacific Railroad. My father was a railroad engineer. And in November 12th, 1951, the city of San Francisco rear-ended the city of Los Angeles, two of the best passenger trains on the Union Pacific Railroad, in a blinding snowstorm outside of my hometown. The engineer on the city of San Francisco didn't see a red block signal, went through it, and the crash occurred. There were 21 or 22 dead, many, many more injured. But as I started researching this train wreck, which I remembered because my father had taken me out and had shown me the train wreck when I was an 11-year-old boy, what I didn't know is that many of the passengers on the city of San Francisco had been at the American College of Surgeons Clinical Congress 4 days before and were taking the train back to Chicago. And a number of those surgeons and their families were killed in this train crash. One surviving surgeon, an orthopedic surgeon, became a local hero because he broke into the dining car of this train and got the wooden orange crates and took the slats of the orange crate and splinted fractures in the snow and blizzard and then went to the hospital and helped the local surgeons. So that kind of set the stage for the way trauma care was in this country. The little hospital could never have handled this mass casualty as it was, 21 dead and many, many more injured, without the help of the surgeons who happened to be on the train. And I thought it was more interesting than anybody else, but I thought, what was the Scudder oration that year at the Clinical Congress? Turned out to be an oration on the treatment of fractures by Sir Reginald Watson Jones, who was the most famous orthopedic surgeon in the world at the time. And so the Scudder oration had been given 4 days before. These surgeons who were treating fractures in the snow in Wyoming that I was watching had been to the lecture in 1951, which I was now giving. I then fast forwarded to 1966, because there wasn't much happening in the United States in terms of any formal trauma centers or formal trauma systems until 1966. That happened to be the year I went to San Francisco to medical school, or started my residency in San Francisco in general surgery. That year, the San Francisco General Hospital and Cook County Hospital in Chicago became the first two real trauma centers in the United States. So my own career in surgery started with the first trauma center. And I showed a picture in this of some of my colleagues who are at the lecture today, who've been leaders in the American College of Surgeons, and certainly in trauma surgery, Dr. Sheldon, Dr. Trunke, Dr. Frank Lewis, and myself. Excuse me. I then talked about San Francisco at that time because I interviewed Dr. Blaisdell, who was the head of the San Francisco General, and he described San Francisco from his perspective in 1966, that it was Medicare, Medicaid had been introduced that year. The mental hospitals all over the country were closed, and those people were on the street, which resulted in a lot of psychiatric problems. It was a lot of drugs, San Francisco at that time, a lot of violence. And the San Francisco General became a de facto trauma center where all of us learned and took care of trauma patients. Later on, Dr. Trunke and Dr. West wrote a paper that really was one of the igniting papers for trauma systems in this country when they compared San Francisco, where Dr. Trunke was, with Orange County, where Dr. West went after being with us in San Francisco. And there was a 33% preventable death rate in Orange County compared to an almost zero preventable death rate in San Francisco. Now, in the lecture, I didn't have time to go into a preventable death and what that is, but simply speaking, what they did was a retrospective autopsy study of everybody who died in Orange County from injury and everybody who died in San Francisco. And then looked at the autopsy findings with a panel of experts and tried to make the determination as to whether had that patient had a surgeon, had they gone to surgery quickly, had they had blood transfusions, could they have survived? And if the answer to that was yes, they were deemed a preventable death. That study pushed the political opposition that existed in Orange County to form a trauma system in Orange County. Dr. West and Dr. Trunke's paper influenced us in San Diego, where I'm from, to do the same thing. We did a preventable death study. Many people thought the death study would show we didn't need a trauma system, that we were doing just fine, with patients being taken to the closest hospital, which is what happens if you don't have a system. In our case, one of 35 hospitals. And lo and behold, we had a 22% preventable death rate in San Diego County. That was what it took for the County Board of Supervisors to make a very courageous decision to have a trauma system, which meant that we would regionalize trauma. That is to say, the most critically injured would now go to one of five designated trauma centers, all children to one pediatric center, rather than going and disperse to 35 hospitals. The upshot of that was our preventable death rate in the first year fell to about 2%. And I showed the graph in the lecture where the preventable death rate has stayed between 0 and 2% through this year. I then, sort of the heart of the lecture was talking about the maps. I had said this is going to be a lecture about maps, surgeons, and patients. I had a map which was, I would consider, the centerpiece of the lecture, which was given to me, allowed to use by Dr. Annist at the CDC, Center for Injury Prevention and Control. And their cartographers had mapped the United States down to the county level, showing color-coded death rates per 100,000. And it's a striking map. When you look at it, red and blue, it looks like the election returns coming in at the last election. The coastal and populated areas are blue, and the rural center of the country is red. And red means you got a much more significant chance of dying from injury. That map was motor vehicle crashes, bicycle crashes, motorcycle crashes, and pedestrians struck. That's what the deaths, they have it for all injury. They could do it for poisoning. They could do it for suicide. They could do it for assault. But I chose to use the one basically on motor vehicle and pedestrian and motorcycle crashes. I then looked at the work of Dr. Charles Brannis at the University of Pennsylvania, and they'd done some mapping, and they did a color-coded map showing the time from the site of injury to a designated level 1 or level 2 trauma center, and they had that color-coded. So I approached Dr. Brannis and said, have you ever thought about matching that with death rates? And he said, no, that's a great idea. So he took his map. Dr. Annis at the CDC let him take his map of death rates. They put that on top of it, and it's dramatic. It shows you that where it takes more than an hour to get to a trauma center, you have a much greater chance of having a higher death rate. Then I decided to go the next step and look at surgeons. We know we have a physician shortage in this country. We know conservative estimates we're going to be short 200,000 doctors in the United States by the year 2020. And what we hear in the current health care reform debate is mostly that we're going to be short primary care physicians. Well, we will be, but we're also going to be short specialists. We're also going to be short of surgeons. And in the case of trauma, it's very significant to be short of trauma surgeons because we don't have people who can replace us. We don't have non-physician clinicians, extenders, whatever you want to refer, nurse practitioners, who can do what trauma surgeons do in somebody of a major injury. So Dr. Sheldon, George Sheldon, past president of the College of Surgeons at the University of North Carolina, and his cartographers had done a beautiful mapping of the United States showing the distribution of surgeons. And it's all surgeons, all specialties. Big blue circles meant there's a lot of surgeons. Little blue circles meant there's none. A dot means there's one. And then if there's no blue, there's no surgeons. I asked them the same question. I said, would you be interested in taking Dr. Annis's death rate per 100,000 and onlaying your distribution of surgeons? They thought that was a good idea. They did that, and it's an absolutely dramatic map. I mean, it's a map we need to take to Washington. You hold it up, and it says, if you don't have a surgeon, your chance of dying in a motor vehicle crash is significantly greater. Where there's no surgeons, it's red, there's big death rates. Where there are surgeons, it's lower. So I then asked the question, what can we do about this? And I really focused on the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma's Committee on Trauma System Consultation. And that's a committee, for a long time we have gone out and looked at trauma centers. But I hope now people will understand that a trauma system is more than just a trauma center. It's pre-hospital, it's prevention programs, it's communication systems, it's rehabilitation. And so this committee, which we actually founded in 1994, which I chaired initially, and then Dr. Robert McCursey chaired after me, and Dr. Mike Rotundo is currently chairing, has now done about 22 states in the United States where we've been invited in to bring in a team and meet with the whole state, with representatives from the pre-hospital, from the ambulance services, the trauma surgeons, the nurses, study their data, look at their data, spend 3 days talking to them, and then produce a report that's a consultative report. We don't go in and say your system passes or fails. We go in and say, this is what we think you need to do to take your system to the next level. That's being well received. There's more and more states requesting these. And even though the survey that I did of the state chairs of trauma, and that was the final map I showed, I surveyed all of our state chairs to see which states had trauma systems, and we mapped that. What we see is that about two-thirds of the states have a trauma system. Now, I didn't drill down and did they have every component that we like to see? Did they have a prevention program? Did they have a registry? But they did at least have enabling legislation and a commitment for a statewide system. And about two-thirds of the states have that. So I think that there is a huge task ahead of this committee to go to even the states that have a system of how to move to the new level, or go to a state that has virtually nothing and help them get started. That's our task. Then I concluded by asking, do trauma systems make any difference? I showed some data, Ellen McKenzie's paper, New England Journal a couple of years ago, which is probably the seminal paper, where they showed a 25% increased chance of surviving a major injury if you were taken to a level one trauma center. And this is probably the strongest evidence we have when people are, what is the evidence that a trauma system makes a difference? But I decided to go one step further and use an example that to me as a surgeon is always more powerful than a map or a table or statistical analysis. And I presented the case of Johan and Jenna Otter. Johan is an employee of ours at Scripps Healthcare System in San Diego, friend of mine. He and his daughter, a couple of years ago for her senior trip, wanted to go hiking. And he asked me to help him set up a trip, and I did in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, because I'm from Wyoming. They went on to Glacier, and in Glacier National Park, early one morning, they were out first on the trail and came face to face with a sow grizzly bear with two cubs. Jenna was in front. The sow attacked, the grizzly bear attacked him. Initially hit Jenna until Johan incredibly heroically got himself between the bear and his daughter. The bear mauled him very badly, ripped his scalp off, broke his neck, broke all of his ribs, injured his eye. Jenna had a major laceration of her whole side of her face opened up, bites all over her body. Johan finally took her over a 30-foot cliff with him trying to get away from the bear. They landed on a ledge. The bear followed them down and continued to maul them. People saw them, fortunately, on the ledge. Therein ensued a heroic helicopter rescue, and they were 6 hours on that ledge. He, I don't know why he didn't bleed to death, but he didn't. Got them out. They were resuscitated and stabilized in Kalispell, Montana, the little community hospital. The inclusive trauma system concept prevailed because Jenna stayed and was treated there appropriately. Johan was immediately airlifted to Harborview in Seattle, where he had life-saving, life-restoring surgery. And they came today, and I introduced them as an example to answer the question, do trauma systems work? And then finally, I concluded with describing the military trauma system that's been put in place for the current war in Iraq. And some of us have had the opportunity as civilian surgeons to go over as visiting professor to Landstuhl, Germany, which is the evacuation hospital for the war. And when I was there in the summer of 07, the first patient I treated was a Marine that had been hit by an IED, lost his right leg and was bleeding to death from his left leg, was saved initially by the medics who put tourniquets on, then was saved in a forward field hospital where they completed the amputation, stopped the bleeding, put a shunt in the artery that was injured so the blood flow to the left leg could be preserved. Was then operated on in Balad at what's called a combat support hospital where they fixed the artery in his left leg. And within 23 hours, he was evacuated in a big C-17 transport to Landstuhl, where I operated on him several times. And then he went on from there to the United States, initially to Bethesda because he was a Marine, and then to San Diego Naval Hospital for rehab. And I saw him when he was in San Diego. The Admiral called me and said, Corporal Gatsby said you would come and see him here. So I went down to see him. And he was working on his rehab, did not yet have his above-knee prosthesis at that time. And then I got an email from his mother, who I'd met when I went to see him. And that email in June 29th, said, Dr. Eastman, William wanted me to let you know he got married. He met his wife while hiking in Sequoia National Park. They got married. They sent the wedding picture, which I showed. I think I showed the wedding picture. And she said, William's first son will be born on July 21st. That is 2 years exactly to the day of when he was injured in Iraq. And I had a picture of Kyle, his son, and so on. And Corporal Gatsby came. And then he stood up, and I wanted him acknowledged as a brave Marine and patient. And then I had all the military surgeons in the audience, or people who had served in Iraq in any way, to stand and let Corporal Gatsby, as one of 50 plus thousand injured soldiers, acknowledge them. So that's the way the lecture concluded. And I guess I concluded with another map and the DART landing in the United States and Canada, because I addressed the Canadian situation in the same way, making a plea for that we as surgeons needed to take this information and garner whatever support we need in this arena of healthcare reform to be sure that the patients, that the nation's number one public health problem, which is trauma, is not totally disregarded, which at the current time it is. That may be more than you wanted to know, but...
It was a wonderful question. Do you have any questions for him? At the end, I may have her ask the question and pick it up for the recording.
Yeah, thank you. Is this on?
Yeah.
So it's Christina Prangu with General Surgery News. You spoke about some of the gaps in the United States in trauma centers, and I wondered where the worst gaps are for a lack of trauma centers.
Where geographically are the gaps?
Yeah.
I think the glaring gap, both in the United States and Canada, is in rural America. Gaps in terms of hospitals, gaps in terms of surgeons. So I think quite clearly the gap is rural America. Now, that's not to say that some of our urban trauma centers are not also struggling for lack of support, and particularly with the physician shortage, where they don't have enough specialists, they don't have enough neurosurgeons to provide call, they don't have enough hand surgeons to take care of complex injuries. So I think we have a gap in many places and just the absolute lack of hospitals, nurses, and surgeons. And then we have a gap of virtually almost everywhere of a total inclusive trauma system.
And you spoke about having a lack of surgeons, and I know George Shelton has talked a lot about that as well, and the difficulties of trying to draw more people into surgery. How can they attract more surgeons to trauma in particular?
Well, how can we attract more surgeons mm-hmm. into trauma? I think that's becoming a more reasonable possibility because, first of all, I don't understand why everybody doesn't want to be a trauma surgeon. It's exciting. It encompasses all of surgery when you're a trauma surgeon. You operate on all parts of the body. So intellectually, the physiology of trauma is challenging. So I think the fundamental intellectual stimulation and challenges of trauma surgery will always attract some young surgeons who want to go into trauma. I think creating an environment of an inclusive trauma system in which they can function will make it more attractive to them. It's not very attractive to know you're going to go be a trauma surgeon in a hospital, whether it's an urban, suburban, or rural area, and you're the only one there. There's going to be no system around you that in the middle of the night when you're hit with a critically injured patient and you need help to not provide help. So I think a system which allows those people who are committed to taking care of injured patients to work together, I think that will attract, will be more attractive. One thing we have to do, I didn't get into this in my lecture, but over 60% of many of the medical school classes now are women. And we really need to figure out how to make trauma surgery an attractive specialty for women. And I think that can be. And I speak, when I talk about women surgeons, my mother-in-law was the first woman surgeon in San Diego. She was the first woman surgeon to train at Sloan Kettering and Memorial in New York. She's an oncology surgeon. And she went on to have 9 children, including my wife, fortunately. So I am a strong advocate for making sure that women, because they are going to be over half of the surgical workforce, I believe, that we make trauma surgery attractive to them.
One of the questions that often comes up with trying to attract more women to surgery is the idea of bringing in shift work or limited hours so that people aren't working.
Well, yeah, sort of by the nature of it, trauma tends to fall in that category. Most of our trauma centers, the surgeons actually do work shifts. Have to do that because you're, as a trauma surgeon at a level 1 or a level 2 trauma center, you have to be in-house. You have to stay in the hospital 24 hours. That's an amazing commitment to make. But when you're off, you're off. That has a certain appeal to people going into surgery as opposed to other areas of surgery where, you know, you're in a group practice and you're always on. So
you mentioned a shortage of hand surgeons. Is there any other fields that are particularly noticeable?
I mentioned hand surgery. That's one right now that many of us are aware of. My understanding is from data from the American Board of Surgery that only, I have to double check this, but only one hand surgeon came out, a new hand surgeon this year. And yet the hand gets injured a lot and it requires the expertise. So hand surgery is one. Neurosurgery is always an issue. Neurosurgeons, there's, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 in the entire United States. That is not enough to have one in every single hospital, every single emergency room. That's where the concept of regionalization has to come in. If we're going to get patients to the level of care they need, we're going to have to concentrate those resources, which is what trauma systems do. So you concentrate those resources and get the patient to the right place. And that's the way we overcome, I think we will necessarily have to overcome the physician shortage. And that will be with neurosurgery, it'll be with orthopedic surgery, it's going to be with hand surgery, and other areas. It's with general surgery.
That's everything.